This is Weekend Ag Matters, produced by the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network and News Talk 1540 KXEL. Here are your hosts, Dustin Hoffman and Anna Hastert.
Well, welcome to Weekend Ag Matters. I'm Dustin Hoffman, your host this week, and along with me is...
Anna Hastert.
Well, we got through another week, didn't we?
We did. It was a busy week, but we made it through.
Let's take a look at some of the top stories we've been following this week. Optimism is growing that the U.S. and China could wrap up a trade agreement this month. Trade officials from the U.S. and China concluded talks in Beijing on Wednesday, with another critical round scheduled for this coming week in the U.S. The Trump administration has appeared to be ready to walk away if an agreement isn't reached soon. However, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said on Twitter that he and Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer concluded productive meetings this week. The South China Morning Post reported the U.S. had dropped the demand that China halts all alleged instances of commercial cyber theft to bring an end to long-running tariff disputes. A deal at this point between the U.S. and China is expected mid-May, with a possible signing of the agreement planned for June. However, an agreement doesn't mean an end to the tariffs. The U.S. is planning on keeping some tariffs on China, and China will likely keep retaliatory tariffs on U.S. ag products, according to Chinese trade experts.
Yeah, and Dustin, sticking on the same topic of trade, President Donald Trump promises agriculture will be a focal point in trade talks with Japan. Farmers are hoping a deal with Japan will make up for lost market access after the U.S. withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Japan and TPP member countries have signed a new agreement now, and it is in place, giving other nations reduced tariffs and improved access to Japan, resulting in a decline of U.S. products flowing to Japan. Before meeting with Japan's prime minister last week, Trump stated that the two would be discussing agriculture. Japan will be seeking market access in return, which could include growing markets for its specialty agricultural products. The U.S. and Japan earlier this month agreed to accelerated trade talks in hopes of reaching a speedy deal by focusing on agriculture and automobile trade.
One of those places that's been watching how our trade relations are going is South America. And following a trip to South America, House Ag Committee Chairman Colin Peterson said he believes South America as a competitor to the U.S. will only become stronger with time. Peterson led a delegation to South America to see firsthand its impact and potential in the global ag trade. The delegation saw the commitment South America has to improve its infrastructure, which has been a key issue holding back the region when it comes to exports. During meetings, the delegation learned that the country is looking to attract billions in private investment to improve the country's infrastructure, in particular its capacity of its ag supply chain. Peterson says it's only a matter of time before infrastructure investments improve the export of ag products and cut into the competitive advantage of the U.S. and what they enjoy over South America. Peterson says the Chinese are happy to buy everything the South Americans can grow right now, and while the U.S. is embattled in trade negotiations facing retaliatory tariffs.
And not only is trade a key topic this week, but also crop production. And on Monday, the Department of Agriculture extended the deadline to May 17th from May 1st for producers to certify 2018 crop production for payments through the Market Facilitation Program. The Trade Relief Program payments will be issued only if eligible producers certify acres before the updated May 17th deadline. Farm Service Agency Administrator Richard Fordyce says the deadline was moved because of rainfall and snowfall delayed harvests in many parts of the country, preventing producers from certifying acres. The program helps producers who have been significantly affected by foreign tariffs, resulting in the loss of traditional exports, according to the USDA. MFP provides payments to producers of corn, cotton, sorghum, soybeans, wheat, dairy, hogs, fresh sweet cherries, and shelled almonds. To date, more than $8.3 billion has been paid to nearly 600,000 applicants. Producers can certify production by contacting their local FSA office or through farmers.gov.
A majority of farmers and farm workers say financial issues, farmer business problems, and fear of losing the farm impact farmers' mental health. Other factors include stress, weather, the economy, isolation, and social stigma, according to a new national poll commissioned by the American Farm Bureau Federation. Polling found that many rural adults have either personally sought care or have a family member who has sought care for a mental health condition. 75% of rural adults says it's important to reduce the stigma about mental health in the agriculture community, while only 66% of farmers and farm workers said the same. Large majorities of rural Americans polled agreed that cost, social stigma, and embarrassment would make it harder for them to seek help or treatment for mental health conditions. In response to the results, AFBF President Zippy Duvall said, "We can and must do more to address farmer stress and mental health issues in rural America." Those are some of our top stories here on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network and Weekend Ag Matters. We'll be right back.
Farm Credit Services of America is pleased to report record cashback dividends of more than $230 million. For many of our customer owners, the share of earnings that benefits their operations and helps support their local communities is needed this year more than ever. We're proud to have shared more than $1.7 billion since 2004. Discover the power of ownership at FCSAmerica.com. Agriculture works here.
You're listening to Weekend Ag Matters from the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. Here again is Anna Hastert.
One topic that I find great interest in nowadays is aquaculture. Now, growing up, my uncle had a farm pond, which we would visit regularly, but I never really was crazy about putting the worm on the hook or taking the fish off the hook for that matter. As I've gotten older, I've learned to get past those couple things and actually really do enjoy fishing. There's just something about fish that intrigues me, and I think that's why I'm attracted to the aquaculture industry. Thankfully, earlier this week, I had the opportunity to sit down and learn a little bit more about the aquaculture industry, not only in Iowa, but across the Midwest. And I found out the aquaculture industry is growing. I sat down with Greg Trusso, who is Global Aquaculture Supply Director and one of its founding members, and talk to him about the technologies that have sparked a change in that industry and have really allowed more people to get invested in it. So why don't you kick back and relax and listen to what Greg has to say about this somewhat new industry and some of the opportunities that it provides to Iowa farmers. Greg, let's just talk about the climate of the aquaculture industry here in the Midwest.
We see a lot of great advances in the aquaculture industry here. Our company is mostly focused on providing aquaculture systems, equipment, and facilities, along with servicing those facilities. So we actually get to see a great number of these places all over the world, and we see a lot of growth coming from this area. We think there's a lot of interest in farming because there's such a rich history of farming in the area, and a lot of folks are looking to diversify into different species and catch the new wave of farming, which in a lot of places we see as fish, just due to the growth in consumer desires for the product and some changes in the, I guess you could say, just climate surrounding the animals in general.
Yeah, and you focus on the supply side. Let's talk about maybe some of the newer products that are coming out that are helping growers expand their operations. I know on the panel today you talked about there is kind of a shift towards much larger operations. What are some of those newer technologies or pieces of equipment that you see them implementing in their operation?
Yeah, so traditionally aquaculture in the past was always focused on, back when things started out, it was always focused on fish grown in ponds all around the world. You know, basically dig a pond out, put some fish in there, and start throwing food in it and see what comes out at the end of the year or 2 years, whatever your growing cycle is. Then aquaculture moved a little towards floating net pens where you have a big cage full of fish out in the ocean. And now we're seeing a big shift towards land-based recirculating aquaculture systems, which is what our company focuses on. Those use large above-ground tanks, sophisticated filtration systems, you know, mechanical pumps, automation systems, and really bring a new level of technology to the aquaculture facilities. Those systems have been around for about the past 30 years now, and we're really starting to see them kind of come into, I think, their best form now. Now the technology changes are all just driven by increasing efficiency and lowering cost of production, so we can make it a lower barrier of entry for new producers and make it more profitable for existing ones.
Yeah, and let's just talk a little bit more about the company that you work for and kind of what your goal is in helping the aquaculture industry, not only in the Midwest, but across the United States as well.
Yeah, so our company, like I said, we focus on designing, servicing, and providing equipment for facilities. So really, we provide a start-to-finish solution. What we want to do for people is enable our customers to produce fish, shrimp, whatever product it is that they may have, at the highest level of profitability for them. So make it an easy entry into the aquaculture world, help them get started, help them with anything from maybe as simple as species selection to bioplanning to planning their production processes, all the way through helping them build a facility. And then after that, making sure that they know how to operate everything properly and can service their facility efficiently up until the first harvest or long after that, and then hopefully see them continue to grow. Our goal at the end of the day is for more aquaculture facilities to be built around the country and around the world. We want to see the growth of the seafood industry and the aquaculture-produced seafood industry just as much as every other producer out there.
And what's the best way for people to get a hold of you guys or find a little bit more about the products that you offer?
Yeah, so they can take a look at our website. It's just simple enough, www.globalaquaculturesupply.com. Or they can always give us a call at 844-946-4272.
All right, Greg, that's all the questions I had for you today. Anything else you would like to add here in our conversation?
No, that's it. Thanks for the time and thanks for the conversation today.
Greg, I really enjoyed having you sit down here to talk with us on Weekend Ag Matters. Look forward to catching up with you here in the future.
Here again is Dustin Hoffman.
Welcome back to Weekend Ag Matters here on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network, joined by Brian Grossman of Zahner Ag Hedge. Brian, how you doing today?
Oh, doing pretty good. It's finally not raining here, and the sky is actually clear, so we might have a nice day with a little bit of wind, so hopefully some guys are getting dried out there.
I'm going to say, if anybody's listening to this and it is raining, we can blame Brian Grossman for jinxing us in the future. So,
So,
speaking of in the future, next week the WASDE report comes out, and I know everybody's waiting with, I don't know, is it panicked breath to find out what it's going to say?
Well, we definitely have a lot of fear. I don't think we're in the panic portion of it yet. That definitely will come. Last couple of years, we've been seeing it closer to harvest. But, you know, none of these prices are looking all that favorable, and planting progress is giving guys a challenge. There's not much motivation right now.
You know, and when I looked at the markets earlier this week, I made the comment that I said, you know, corn was trying to hang on to some small gains it had that day. Beans was struggling to hang on to anything it can find. It's just been kind of on a downward roll here.
Yeah, and the soybean market is under pressure for a lot of reasons. You know, right off the bat, we're definitely down on our exports. It's no secret. But the U.S. dollar is not helping anything. A strong economy comes with a strong currency. And unfortunately, that's bad for an export market. And we do have the dollar trading near its contract high right now at 97.40. And the way that that influences the markets is when we're looking to exports, we're talking about other nations' currencies. So let's take China for an example. For them to buy from the United States, they have to buy something at a higher currency rate. So it's more expensive for them to buy from the U.S. versus buy from the Brazil market or Argentina, for an example, which their currency is not near a contract high. It's actually bouncing on an all-time record low, which makes it that much harder for us. So we have that problem staring us in the face at the same time that South America also has harvest pressure bearing down. So their prices are just cheaper than us. It's basically just that. And what's really helping drive our soybeans along here has been our domestic crush, which last couple months we have been at or near record for their respective month. And it looks like we're going to set a record for annual crush or market year crush. But, you know, that can be a self-feeding monster like you and I were talking about earlier. With strong crush margins, we do consume soybeans in the short term because there's an incentive to crush them and get the soy meal. But as the soy meal market goes down, eventually those crush margins will go down, and we're going to see that crush rate slow, which unfortunately might happen here in the summer months when producers want to be moving soybeans. So that could be a bit of a challenge here when we are talking not only futures but basis as well.
You know, when we're talking about the fact that we have a lot of soybeans just sitting here waiting, we've talked about that in the past. And, you know, you talk about the soy meal, but it still seems that no matter what form the soybeans are sitting in, we still have a lot of them sitting around.
Absolutely. There's no denying it. We're going to be at a record-ending stock here for soybeans, and China definitely could make a difference, but it goes back to the currency issue, and it's not smart money for them to buy from us right now. So even if we get a trade deal, we're going to have to ask China to pay more to satisfy that trade deal if it involves soybeans. That could change here in a couple months when we're having harvest pressure and South America is not. We'll become the cheapest again. But for the meantime here, we're going to be talking a billion-plus bushel ending stock, and it's going to be very hard to avoid it, if not impossible.
And, you know, we talk about the monetary value of it, too, and what's causing that. But also, when you look at China, you know, I'm sure African swine fever is playing a big role in what the bean markets are doing, too, because that's less meal that they're wanting to consume.
Absolutely. Not only is it less that China's consuming in general, but now that's going to say, where is the Brazilian soybeans going to go? They've been known for feeding the Chinese market. Now that's going to be on the hunt. Are they going to become competitive enough where the European Union starts to favor them? Or, you know, Argentina is going to be a big role in that as well for the soy meal and the European Union. How willing are our key trading partners going to be to pay more for a U.S. product rather than a cheaper South American?
All right, so as we look ahead to the WASD, Brian, you know, just looking through your crystal ball, what kind of things are you expecting to see out of this report?
So this is going to be actually an interesting report. It's the first time that we're going to see an official balance sheet for the 1920 market year. So we have a rough idea. Prospective planting acres is going to be the acreage. The February Outlook Conference already determined what our starting yield is, and that's going to be a 176. So that really narrows down your supply area. I do think that the 18-19 ending stock number is ultimately going to move higher. So my beginning stocks are going to be higher, but the USDA might not make a real big change on the 18-19 market year, on the corn side at least. Soybeans is going to be a different story. There, the USDA, I don't know how long they can keep avoiding the idea of addressing the soybean export number. They're still at a 1.875, and that number got set back when China was talking about taking deliveries of, you know, upwards of 15 to 20 million metric tons. Well, we are a long cry from them taking anywhere near that amount. They're actually only around 5.6 million metric tons with 13 million bought. So they haven't even bought what they were talking about, much less taken delivery on it. And I don't foresee them doing a real big increase. So with that being said, given their last five-week average, a little bit under 200,000 metric tons, but for, you know, let's take that number and run with it, that is only 2.8 million metric tons here for the quarter four, and, you know, we're not really hitting that average to begin with, so that's going to be really optimistic. So the soybean number, I think, is going to have to grow on this report, and if not, then we might have a tear the Band-Aid off event in the, you know, the summer months, which could be really devastating for the soybean market.
All right, so kind of a perfect storm kind of brewing around us. And if we're farmers and producers holding on to beans and corn right now, I mean, if they're looking for marketing advice this week ahead of that WASD report, what are you thinking?
Well, you know, every situation is different. I know that's a great question that everybody wants to ask. And the problem with it is there is no general answer. The best thing that you can do is get in touch with somebody like myself, a broker, a market strategist, somebody that is more, you know, eyes on the market continuously. Then you have to lay out your cards with them. This is what your situation is. This is what you have. This is what you need. Put out all the cards because you're not keeping secrets from anybody here. And formulate a plan from there, because right now the marketing is a challenge. And, you know, do you sell at this point on soybeans? It really depends on what your situation is. So the best thing is to give somebody a call, someone like myself, and get that plan formulated and move forward from there.
And considering WASD's coming out on Friday, they might want to look at doing that if they haven't already, sooner rather than later.
Absolutely. It's never too late to get a hedge account set up. You know, you can set it up. You don't have to trade immediately, but have it ready to go because anything could happen, anything could change, and if that day comes where you feel like you need to be making a sale, you at least have another tool available to you.
All right, if people need information on how to set one up or get some information on how they should move through these markets, how do they get in touch with you, Brian?
Well, you can reach me directly at 312-277-0119. That is my direct office line, and it also forwards on to my cell phone. But I also encourage everybody to check out my social media pages, Twitter and Facebook. I'm on them frequently, even in the evenings. I'm often talking to producers that are interacting with my pages. I also share a lot of information on there as well, so you can find me on Twitter and Facebook under the handle of AgHedgeBrian.
All right, Brian, thank you very much for taking a few minutes to visit with us here today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's always good to chat with the Iowa Ag Radio.
All right, that's Brian Grossman with Zahner Ag Hedge Group on Weekend Ag Matters. We'll be back after these messages.
You're listening to Weekend Ag Matters from the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. Here is Ken Root.
It was a southern solution to summer survival that took on greater meaning in folklore and reading social status. It was a lightweight doorframe covered with wire mesh that would allow the breeze to pass through but keep the bugs and critters outside. It was primitive as a means to delineate living space, but a part of our lives and an integral part of our past. There is even a rude phrase that remains in our culture today, suggesting a person who is not welcome should leave and not let the screen door hit them on the backside as they go out. We lived in an old red house for the first 11 years of my life. It had been built in several sections and had no two parallel walls, nor any right angles within the structure. The doors fit, mostly, but there were gaps that couldn't be filled. We had no air conditioning other than a southern breeze, so come late March, the doors and windows were open most of the time. Screen doors were flimsy and held shut with a long spring that was often ill-fitted to the task. Either the door would flop back and hit the wall, or it would slam shut with the sound of a rifle piercing the air. The screen wire was thin and could be damaged by being kicked from the inside by a man or child who was trying to get out without using their hands. The flies found the tears first, and the dogs followed. A little rip of the screen often got bigger as the summer went on. Soon the small dogs and a few cats would get bold enough to go through, and then the door became pretty much useless for its original purpose. When the door slammed, it meant someone had left the house, and the harder it slammed, the more dramatic their departure. A moderate slam would be my sister late for the school bus, but an echoing clap of thunder would mean my brother was storming out after fighting with my father. In the hot days of summer, my mother would put a wet dish towel on the kitchen door spring so the incoming breeze might be a bit cooler. She would wipe the sweat from her eyes and keep on stirring dinner. As soon as the inside work was done, she'd go out on the front porch under the cottonwood trees to find a better place to cool down. Rain was a welcome respite in the heat of summer and would often come from an afternoon thunderstorm that blew in cool with sheets of water falling heavy for a few moments. The breeze would angle the drops against the screen where they would cut themselves in small pieces and provide a cool mist to anyone standing inside. One year we bought a black rubber ball that would swing out and hit the jamb on the first pass when the door swung shut. That dampened the force, and the door would bounce out and then quietly settle in. The problem was that the ball took such punishment, either from normal use or from me playing with it, that it wore out and rolled away after a couple of weeks. We also had a wooden spool, void of thread, attached to the door down low enough that a small child could pull it open. It saved a lot of crying and was a step toward self-reliance. Perhaps millennials could use something like that today. A screen door distorts vision of objects on the other side, but only slightly. You could look in or out of a screen and pretty much see everything that was going on. If you move slightly, while you keep your eyes on a distant point, the screen will disappear. When looking at a person standing close to the door, it gives a texture that has not been lost on photographers all the way back to Ansel Adams. Scenes through a screen door are often etched in our memory. I remember my mother looking out with apprehension as I proudly rode up on top of a load of hay heading for the barn. The world was more open then. The sights and sounds were vivid, as houses were only thin barriers to the outside world. Now we have heavy, tempered glass doors that keep the cool air in and seal tightly around the edges. They have hydraulic dampers, so they close slowly and securely. Some have a means to slide the glass down and pull a screen into place to simulate the days when fresh air was free from heaven. Screen doors were a rural utility. Now they indicate poverty. Screen is now fiber and not wire, and much more durable. We love it in seasonal rooms, but look at it with pity when it's on ramshackle houses where the mesh is still used for its original purpose. I look at screens as windows to the past. When I do, I can still see my mother standing there, work-worn and weary, but smiling, as she saw me coming home.
And that's it for Weekend Ag Matters here on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Dustin Hoffman on behalf of Anna Hastert and Ken Root here at the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network studios. Have a great week ahead, and we'll see you next weekend.